Preachers and prophets also had their eyes on the clock. Charles T. Russell, leader of the U.S.-based Jehovah's Witnesses, forecast Armageddon in 1914, and the word was on many European lips. However, instead of being the war to end all wars, the Great Match became the war to end the British Empire. Its conclusion in the cynical Peace of Versailles in 1919 set the scene for a follow-up 20 years later that finished off what was left of British overseas investment and the reveries of 19th-century headmasters. A fifth bellwether of imperial decline, already suggested in Part 1, lies in the seeming inability of leading powers to avoid dangerous overreach in international commitment, and in foreign military involvement and its cost. These decisions can seem necessary, or at least plausible at the time, with hubris helping. The unwise economic, political, and military overstretch usually becomes entirely clear only in retrospect, although sometimes it does not take long. Rome, for example, was obliged to defend some far-flung frontiers in North Africa and along the Rhine and Danube. However, historians fault both the choice of perimeters and the draining expense of large armies and extravagant frontier defensive systems, most of which were never attacked as the empire rotted from within and foes came from unexpected directions. For the Spanish, Dutch, and British, the costs of war and empire became problems within a generation or two of their imperial zeniths. The economic impact in trade and debt will be discussed in Part 3, but it is appropriate here to note the conflicts that did so much damage. For Spain, the 80 years of off-and-on war in the Netherlands, the Dutch Revolution, beginning in 1570, took on a European and even global breadth in the 30 Years' War, which broke the back of Spanish power. The Dutch, in turn, were obliged to fight France in 1672 when Louis XIV invaded with a huge force, although the results were surprisingly inconclusive. However, the subsequent quarter century of Anglo-Dutch war with France was hard on the United Provinces, not least because their hereditary stadtholder, William of Orange, had also become King of England. The Dutch assumed a larger role than they could afford and paid the price. In retrospect, these wars facilitated England's political and economic emergence at Dutch expense. The next example is all too familiar. Two centuries later, the First and Second World Wars led to the end of the British Empire and announced the arrival of the United States as the new leading world economic power. The Cold War led to a contest between the two military superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union, which the United States won in the late 1980s. One unfortunate result was hubris and triumphalism. The obvious question of the 21st century is whether oil, or religion-based conflict in the Middle East, or some broader resource war may punish American overstretch. For such powers past their zenith, religion, our subject in these chapters, is usually one of a larger set of interconnected factors. The need to condense this discussion into a dozen pages results in descriptions and citations that can make these analogies seem too pat. Nevertheless, I have not found any contrary arguments. Typically, that these declines have been exaggerated, at all convincing. Suffice it to say that even at considerable discount, these precedents should unnerve readers weaned on American exceptionalism and unaware of how much doubt prior history casts on that uniqueness. A 21st Century American Disenlightenment? The frequent byproducts of religious fervor in the later stages of the previous powers, zealotry, exaltation of faith over reason, too much church-state collaboration, or a contagion of crusader mentality, shed light on another contemporary U.S. predicament. Controversies that run the gamut from interference with science to biblically inhibited climatology and petroleum geology and demands for the partial reunion of church and state have accompanied the political rise of Christian conservatism. Such trends are rarely auspicious. The essential political preconditions fell into place in the late 1980s and 1990s with the emergence of the Republican Party as a powerful vehicle for religiosity and church influence. While state Republican parties, most conspicuously in the South and Southwest, endorsed so-called Christian Nation Party platforms. These unusual platforms, as yet nationally uncatalogued, set out in varying degrees the radical political theology of the Christian Reconstruction Movement, the tenets of which range from using the Bible as a basis for domestic law to emphasizing religious schools and women's subordination to men. The 2004 platform of the Texas Republican Party is a case in point. It reaffirms the status of the United States as a Christian nation, regrets the myth of the separation of church and state, calls for abstinence instead of sex education, and broadly mirrors the Reconstructionist demand for the abolition of a large group of federal agencies and departments, including the Energy Department and the Environmental Protection Agency. George W. Bush's election to the presidency and his unusual choice of former Missouri Senator John Ashcroft to head the Justice Department were true milestones. We have already seen Bush's involvement in intensifying the religiosity of the Republican Party and in linking White House policy statements to scripture and prophecy.